Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and a very good morning. Coming up in the programme, former President Mary McAleese on her Belfast childhood and the Troubles, fighting to be heard as a nationalist in RTE, and those five special words in Irish from Queen Elizabeth's state visit. Billy Keane will mark a bittersweet week for publicans when he speaks to us live from the legendary John B's bar in Listowel, and we've got the story of one young politician's brush with mortality. You can text us to 51551, you can email Miriam at rt.ie, or you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, my first guest this morning, well, he was a prominent figure in the last government as Minister for Local Government and a regular Fine Gael spokesman on television and radio. John Paul Phelan was one of the youngest politicians ever elected to a local council and to the Shannon, and he's been a TD now for nearly a decade. But earlier this summer, his life changed when at the age of just 41, he suffered an almost fatal heart attack. Well, I'm glad to say he's recovering very well, and he joins me now from his home in County Kilkenny. John Paul Phelan, good morning to you and happy birthday, I believe.
Thank you, Miriam, and thanks for the birthday wishes. Yeah.
Delighted. Listen, John Paul, you became ill on the 12th of July this year, but you'd been feeling unwell before that, hadn't you?
Yeah, myself and my wife Claire, we were actually above in Leitrim in her home place when the COVID restrictions came in, the lockdown started. And we obviously had to stay there. And as it happened, it would be, you know, I hadn't done as much probably physical work for years as I did during the lockdown period, doing bits and pieces with her parents up at their home place. But I got a pain one day. I filled their garage essentially with timber. And I'd say it's something that many people did during the lockdown period. And I got this pain, but it was gone in kind of 10 or 15 minutes, and I didn't really pay any attention to it. I mean, I put it down to smoking, which was a bad habit that I had for a long time, but I haven't had since July. When this day, actually 11 weeks ago, the 12th of July was the day it happened, a little bit later in the day, around lunchtime. And that pain came back, but it was still there after about 40 minutes, and I started throwing up, and Claire loaded me into the car and off to the hospital, thankfully.
And when that happened to you, John Paul, I mean, 41, did you think it had anything to do with your heart? What did you think was wrong with you?
I didn't for a second, which was a kind of, you know, I suppose I should have, in the sense that thinking back into my own family history, there's been a bit of heart disease on both sides. I suppose you don't really think at 41 that it's going to be a heart attack. Actually, one of the things the cardiac nurses in the cardiac care unit in University Hospital Waterford said to me is that they see a lot of people, you know, in their 30s and even sometimes in their 20s now. I mean, it's something that is much more common for younger people, but I hadn't thought about my family history before, and I should have, and I should have got myself tested. But thankfully, you know, when I went in, I was kept overnight, monitored, and on that Monday morning, then the angioplasty to open, it was 100% blockage in one artery. It's purely, I wouldn't say purely, but mostly a genetic issue that I had, and the stents have done their job, and the artery is still open, and the other arteries, thankfully, are in good shape. And now it's about me maintaining and making sure that they remain in good shape.
But actually, John Paul, when you say, I mean, 100% blockage, yeah. I think it was in your left anterior downward artery.
Yeah.
Tell me what the cardiologist, one of them, actually said to you about how lucky you were.
Yeah, that was actually, and it was after the event. I didn't really realize at the time, I suppose, the you know, the seriousness of the situation. But he said to me afterwards, I mean, I just, in my own kind of layman's terms, said, you know, I got my warning. I suppose I would have had a much more serious event in, you know, a few weeks or a few months. And he just looked and said, you know, you would have had a fatal event within a matter of hours if you hadn't have had that warning, for want of a better term. And that did kind of put it all in perspective. you know, I had a first cousin last year. I don't know the exact details of his illness, but he at 37 years of age, and he was a man and was much more fit than me. Padraig ran marathons and used to cycle the Ring of Kerry every year since it started. And at 37, he never woke up for work one Tuesday morning. So, I mean, I should have been much more conscious of it. And I would say to your listeners this morning, I mean, if there's any bit of heart disease in their family, go get yourself checked, you know, do the stress test, do the angiograms, because it's something, I suppose, that's very simple and straightforward. I mean, I had the angioplasty opened the artery. I was kept for a week because I had a massive clot in my heart, which had to be dissolved. And a week later, I had this one very, very large stent that was put in, and that has more or less, hopefully, solved the hereditary weakness that was there. And now I you know, I'm trying to eat better. I'm trying to exercise better, get my 10,000 steps a day. And I'm feeling, to be honest, I'm feeling better than I have done for a number of years, Miriam. I don't have the fatigue that I had. And also, you know, I put on an awful lot of weight, which was partly at least down to kind of fluid retention because of the blockage I had.
So in a sense, John Paul, do you feel very lucky that you've almost been given a second chance? And does that change your attitude to life and how you live your life and what you appreciate in your life?
That's exactly how I feel. I was warned by a few friends that I know who had similar sort of events that I'd be very, you know, potentially very down after it. And, you know, that fear of your own mortality. I just think of my first cousin, who was the most happy. He was the life and soul of the party kind of guy, Porrick, who isn't around anymore now. That was only 12 months ago. And I feel that I've kind of cheated what happened to him and has happened to other people that I know and other people that everyone knows. And it's up to me now to, you know, use the second chance that I've got to make sure that I live as healthily as I can. I mean, obviously the lifestyle of politics brings its own issues, but there's still, you know, the cigarettes are gone. I haven't had one since. And I mean, if I don't give them up now, as I tell everyone, you know, I'll never have a better excuse for giving them up. And, you know, I do feel, you're right, I do feel that I have kind of cheated it. But it's up to me now to maintain it and to make the most of the second chance that I've gotten.
I gather your party leader, Leo himself, a doctor, took a look at your report and has ordered you to take it handy.
Yeah, he did. And like, I'll be perfectly honest, with restrictions on COVID, I mean, it's one of the things that we all say in relation to COVID, but people who have underlying issues, I'm one of those people now. And there's so many of them all across our country that we just don't know, that are living perfectly full, busy, hectic lives, but have issues. So obviously I don't want, the doctors have warned me not to get it. I also don't want to be giving it to them, you know. I mean, the cardiac care unit in Waterford is a small enough unit, vital, but I don't want to end up, you know, bringing it into to some of those staff. The nurses and doctors there save my life effectively, and they do that every day with people across our region. So you know, obviously I have to take particular measures, but I'm up and about now, and you know, doing the kind of local political stuff. I would say also, I mean, you spoke about you know, having a new lease of life, or it has re-energized my interest in the small stuff about politics. Like I was elected when I was a student. I was 20 years of age to the council in Kilkenny in the summer of 1999, which is a long time ago now. But I've spent the last few weeks kind of reconnecting with the mundane aspects of what politicians do. Like when someone comes to you, no matter how small the problem is, it's the biggest thing in their lives at that moment, you know. And I must say, I'm enjoying that kind of sense of doing the smaller tasks, which are, you know, the crucial ones so often for families that are under pressure, you know.
Well, look, John Paul Phelan, good luck with your ongoing recovery. Delighted it all turned out so well for you in the end. And thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me this morning on your birthday. And look after yourself. Coming up after the break, I'm going to be speaking to former President Mary McAleese from her home in County Roscommon.
Tweet @Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And a reminder also, you can text us to 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie. Well, this week, former President Mary McAleese published a much anticipated memoir of her life and her two terms in Áras an Uachtaráin. It's called Here's the Story. Mary McAleese, good morning to you.
How are you, Miriam? Good to talk to you.
Me too. I really enjoyed your book. It's very, very interesting. I was just thinking, though, as
we speak now,
I think you're sitting in your home in Coote Hall in County Roscommon. And of course, you were born up north, lived in Dublin a lot, up there now. Where does your heart think is home, Mary?
Oh, where I am right now, without a shadow of a doubt. I look out my window and I'm looking straight across at the back window of my father's home, where his people have lived for centuries, never moved from there, centuries. Not far away is a little abbey dedicated to St. Aidan a millennium ago, that was founded by the Lenehan family, whom I like to think were his family, because he, of course, was Lenehan. So I feel very at home here. I absolutely love, you know, the Roscommon area. We're very close to Carrick and Shannon here. It's our nearest town, and it has to be the most beautiful town on the Shannon, one of the most beautiful towns in Ireland. Great community, very pretty, of course, very pretty and very beautiful. So look, this is home for me. I also, of course, have a great grasp for the north, for the Mourns, and in particular for the village of Rostrever, where my family moved to after a lot of upheaval in Belfast, a lot of bad times and cruel times. They moved to Rostrever, which also is one of the most beautiful villages in Ireland, right on the shores of Carlingford Lough in the foothills of the Mourne Mountains, and a place of great peace for us as a family after, you know, a lot of really rough seas, can I put it that way.
Tell me about your mum and dad, neither of them from Belfast. How did they both end up in Ardoyne?
Yeah, well, my mum, she's one of 11 kids, and her mother and father were both from small farms in the Dromara Hills, just north of the Mourns. But her father had been involved in the old IRA, and for that reason, going back to live there when they were married and having their family was difficult, because there was a lot of sectarian stuff going on. He also found it very hard to get employment, and he'd been back and forth to Scotland working. But he got a job with Barney Hughes's bakery in Maharaa. So my mother actually was born in Derry in Maharaa. Then they came back to Belfast in the 30s, terrible blinking time. There were very few houses going, and unfortunately one of the areas where you could get a house, because nobody really wanted to live there, it was such a dreadful sectarian mess at the time, was where they went to live in Ardoyne. Meanwhile, my father, at the age of 14, born and reared in County Roscommon, got his first pair of shoes at the age of 14 and was put on the train for Belfast, because his mother's three sisters had moved there for work. And they were all then living in Ardoyne. And they were quite entrepreneurial. You know, one had a little grocery, one had an off-license, one had a hairdressing. And my mother, at age 15, went into that hairdresser's as an apprentice. And my father had come to Belfast to be an apprentice barman. And he ran across her as his aunt's apprentice. That's how they met. She was 20 when they got married. He was 26 when they got married. And they continued then to live in Ardoyne. That's where we were all born. We were all born and reared in Ardoyne, nine of us, until, you know, we were machine gunned out of our home there.
Tell me about this man called Pat McAllister.
Oh, Pat. Pat was a wonderful character, worked in our pub. He was a very militant socialist and a really clever, well-read man. And he had gone to Canada as a young fellow and had joined the International Brigade. And with the International Brigade, he sailed to Spain, where he fought against Franco. That didn't endear him, you know, to the Catholic population when he came back to live in Belfast. And he found it hard to get work. But my father, being the kind of man he was, gave Pat a job. So Pat became our barman. And he had diabolical Spanish. He had fluent Spanish, incidentally, but it was absolutely diabolical. And delivered in a deadpan Belfast accent for anybody who knew Pat. So Pat made it his his task was to teach me bad Spanish and socialism, basically, and the words of the International. I never did get the tune because he was completely tuneless. So he was a big part of our lives growing up. He, you know, really, to be honest, as a result of his tutoring, I put in an application. I think I was about 13 to join the Communist Party of Britain and Ireland. My mother nearly had the head staggers, caused awful kerfuffle with the head nun in my school. But thankfully, anyway, that application seems to have died a death. But Pat was fantastic, and he spent every Christmas day with us because he'd nowhere else really to go. He's dead and gone now, God rest him. But he was legendary in Belfast because he was the last of the International Brigade.
And the year you finished school, Mary, your youngest brother was born, Clement. Tell us about how your mum was treated and why it bore so heavily on you.
Well, my mum had 11 pregnancies, out of which came 9 living children. And between the age of 20 and 38, she had 11 pregnancies. And so that meant that, you know, literally every few months she was pregnant and producing children. But by the time she got to Clement, she was really not. Actually, after the eighth child, my brother Phelim, my mother, she was told she really needed a hysterectomy. But unfortunately, she got pregnant again, or fortunately, because of course we got Clement as a result of it, and he's fantastic. But then after Clement, she was really very ill. I was in the middle of my Mach A levels at that time, and my sister Nora was in the middle of her Mach O levels, so the timing wasn't great, to be honest, in our house. My mum came home from hospital with him, and we had to mind him because she literally wasn't fit to put her foot out of the bed, that's the truth. Now, her Catholic doctor, who went on for the priesthood subsequently, but he knew she needed the hysterectomy to save her health and her life, actually. So she was sent to a secular doctor, a Protestant doctor in a secular hospital, had the hysterectomy, came home, and the next thing, Father Honorius, he arrived to the house, oh, really so angry. I can still remember him saying to my mother and father, who were both present in the house, that he had heard that she'd had a hysterectomy and that this was unacceptable because she was still of childbearing age. I'd never heard that expression. She was still of childbearing age and his permission had not been sought. And I still remember how my parents shrank that night. They were so, so hurt, so very hurt. But it stayed with me. It stayed with me. It stayed with her too, actually.
It's actually astonishing when I read that, Mary, that it's hard to believe that things like that happened.
Isn't it?
Mm.
And they happened every day, Miriam. That was the control that was exercised by the church. That was the control. And thank God for, you know, for education. Thank God for the liberation that came and the confidence that came from the generations who were educated and that were able to contradict a church that still regrettably hasn't moved into full acceptance of the reality of those rites, because it still teaches that we are obliged by virtue of our baptismal obligations to be obedient to the church's teaching magisterium, that is the bishops, what they teach. It tells us we are obliged by baptism, you know, to obey. And my answer to that today is no, I'm not. I'm not obliged to obey that. Those baptismal promises and obligations were undertaken allegedly when I was a week old, when I was baptized. You cannot do that. You cannot say to a non-sentient child, you know, at a year or a week or 2 years, that you've now taken on lifelong obligations. And in particular, you can't say it anymore when we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, the European Convention on Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, all of which tell us that we have freedom of thought, conscience and belief. My church has to grow up yet, to mature into that debate. And I, you know, I look forward to being part of that debate. I think it's quite exciting.
I'm conscious also, Mary, you know, that this is a Sunday morning and that there'll be a lot of people listening, almost agreeing with you. And yet, like you, they still love their religion. They still love their church. I'm also aware your wonderful mother is still alive. Do you think people of her generation, Mary, you know, still retain their devotion, in a sense, to the church, but they choose what they want to believe these days? They choose to behave as they want to behave as good Christians.
Yes, I mean, I still am committed to the church. I still regard myself as part of it and have no plans to leave it, even though at times one could be sorely tempted because the management structure is just so appallingly inefficient at the very best and, well, ineffective. And but yes, you're right. I mean, there are generations of people like my parents, like my mother, and who for whom their identity and, if you like, their whole social scene revolves around mass and devotions and prayer mm-hmm. and the rosary and novenas. And this is these are very, very important props in their lives. Why? Because it's got them through a lot of ups and downs and a lot of life's very, very stormy seas. And so I would never take that away from them. Why? Because myself, when I, you know, when I hit the buffers, I turned to prayer almost automatically. I think my mother's generation now, many of them, you know, who had the 9, 10, 11 and children, who devoted their lives to their families, have now grown very sceptical. First of all, feel a deep, deep sense of betrayal by the church when they discover the cover-up by bishops of episcopal, you know, of clerical child sex abuse, which happened in our own family. I mean, the clerical abuse, I won't say sexual abuse, but the clerical abuse that happened, that was covered up by bishops. These were trusted, respected people. Trust was everything. And of course, they've blown that trust. I don't know when it will ever come back. It certainly, that generation is now has grown very sceptical, I think, Miriam.
And of course, it wasn't until much later, wasn't it, that your brother felt able to talk about the abuse he suffered in school. Were you shocked? Did you find that very difficult to deal with?
Well, yes, because, I mean, my brother, my youngest brother, Clement, went to, you know, one of the top Northern Ireland most successful Catholic schools, to Newry. And the headmaster there was an absolutely appalling sexual predator. And was never stopped in his tracks, even though it seems it was well known by his bishop. Indeed, it was known by the bishop who said his funeral mass, who was a great personal friend of our family. And then, of course, who resigned because he realised that presiding over the funeral mass just was really not acceptable. My brother was 50 before he felt able to tell us about what had happened to him at that school at the hands of Father Finnegan. And to say that, you know, it destroyed our peace of mind and certainly had destroyed his for many years unknown to us. I often wondered, he was very, very hostile to the church, very hostile, but at the same time, a person of great deep spirituality, a great metaphysical thinker, a searcher, and, you know, a person who had tried Buddhism and found Buddhism gave him some peace of mind, married to a wonderful Jewish wife. Thank God for her, because she's the person who saw in him that there was something that needed really to be mined and drilled out of him. And with her help, you know, he was able, and the help of good counselling, he was able to tell it. But imagine, my brother's a lawyer. My brother's a trained lawyer. And he's worked in the film industry. You know, he's an expert in health and safety in the film industry. He's a really high achieving man. To think that someone like him could not speak about these things until he got to 50 tells me of the control that these predators had and the protection they had, which is why I think we are entitled to remain for many, many, many decades more sceptical about our senior clerical leaders and their commitment to protection of children.
Meanwhile, there was endless trouble for your family when you were living in Ardoyne. I mean, 69, obviously, Mary, was a big year in world history. You met Martin yourself that year. Tell me about the 14th of August, 1969. What happened that night?
I went out with Father Honorius Kelly, the priest who had told me I could never become a lawyer, but who was now celebrating the fact that I'd got into law school, believe it or not. And so another girl in the parish, a wonderful old friend of mine, Eileen Gilmartin, she had got into UCD, and he was delighted for both of us. Took us out that night for a meal. We left the parish. I'd never been taken out for a meal before in my life, and this was a wonderful thing. Now, it was the week of after the Battle of the Bogside, so things were a bit dodgy, but we never in a million years expected to come back and find her father the most mild-mannered man that ever left Sligo, standing with a group of men at where we came into the parish with hurls in their hand, and we were astounded. And it turned out that the B Specials, who you might remember were an auxiliary police force in uniform, had come into our parish that night with a loyalist rabble, and were pointing out the Catholic houses and burning them. So a lot of Catholic houses and businesses were burnt that night. It was a reign of terror. It wouldn't have been the first pogrom against Catholics in Ardoyne. Historically, there was a history of it. Every second generation or so it happened. But this was the first of my experience of it. And it was devastating. I was about to go to law school, and here were the forces of law and order clearly on one side of the community, and it wasn't mine. This was the start of a civil war, Miriam. That's how it starts. You tell me how it ends, because I thought it would last a week. Then I thought it would last a month. Then maybe a year, and then 30 years later, I thought, oh God, we have to, it has to be brought to an end. And I thought of Dan O'Connell and his memory of being in France, being in Paris during the French Revolution, and seeing there that once that genie of violence is out of the bottle, once it's out of the bottle, no matter how righteous it is, no matter what the cause, once it's out of the bottle, the venom, the contempt, the hate, the murder, the depredation that humanity is capable of is also out of the bottle. You try getting it back in again. Very difficult. It's, of course, what turned Dan O'Connell off the use of violence for the rest of his life. Same here.
And in your memoir, Mary, you speak about your father and the endless attacks. And I know the pub was bombed, your house was attacked, but there's something incredibly moving about the attack on your brother John.
It's the one that really got to me and provoked probably the greatest anger in me, an anger that, that was righteous but needed eventually to give way to calm. But my brother John is profoundly deaf from birth, and he had been at a deaf club and was getting off the bus on his way home. Actually, the bus stop was directly in line with our house. And he was about to cross the road, a main road, when he was attacked by four young loyalist thugs who broke a bottle over his head and then stabbed him with the jagged edges, including severing an artery, and left him for dead. And we were in the house, my mum and the older children, because the younger ones were all in bed, but we could hear the screams. Because John is deaf, the timbre of his voice when he speaks is very different. I had never heard my brother scream, ever. And we thought it was a bunch of kids from a local youth club acting the maggot. And then I still remember this cold chill that ran through me as I realised, oh, sweet God, it's John, it's John. And we ran to the door. Just at that moment, our doorbell rang, and this poor, unfortunate man was standing there, his hands dripping in blood. He could barely speak, and he just brought us out to where John was at the gate of the house. I remember getting into the ambulance with him and praying to God to save him. He survived, thank God, physically survived, emotionally not so. He's had to carry the fear of that and the horror of it all his life. And in particular then the added horror of having recognised his killer, or his attempted killer, I should say. And he recognised him because he was a neighbour. John drew a wonderful picture of him. John's a very good artist, and in fact, he's an excellent artist, and he drew a great photo fit. So the guy was immediately, we all knew who he was. He's very recognisable. John also pointed him out when he was taken by the police to this young man's workplace, and 300 guys come through the gate, and John pointed right to him. But he was never prosecuted. And a few years later, when I was practicing at the bar in my first year at the bar, by accident, I ran into the police officer who had been investigating the attack on John, a very nice young man. I didn't recognise him. He now had a beard, and he stopped me and he said, I remember you. You were a young law student when I first met you, or you were going to do law. He said, what an awful pity that we didn't prosecute that young man then. He said, you know why I'm here? He said, because that young man is now up on a charge of murder. He had murdered the Catholic manager of the Ulster Bank, only a mile from our house. And I said to him, as a matter of interest, why didn't you prosecute. Oh, he said it was, the decision wasn't for me, he said. But, you know, his father, I think, or somebody belonging to him, perhaps not his father, but somebody belonging to him, was very high up in the Orange Order, and they provided him with a cast iron alibi. That was Northern Ireland.
Unbelievable. Look, as we speak this morning, I'm here in the studios of the RTÉ newsroom. You came to RTÉ in 79. It's a fascinating section of your book, Mary, about your time in RTÉ. It's an understatement to say you were unhappy here. I mean, when you think back on that now, Mary, do you think it's partly that down the years, a lot of people I know who grew up in the North, in the nationalist tradition, felt that nobody in the South really either cared or understood or respected what you'd been through? Do you think that lay at the root of it in some way?
It didn't help. But I have to say, I came to work with in Frontline in 1979, the then current affairs programme, a predecessor of Primetime way back. And that the year I spent there was a happy year, Miriam. I worked with people I had great respect for. I think they did good, solid work. That changed. We went to a programme called Today Tonight. I wasn't so happy there, and I wasn't so convinced about its credentials in terms of understanding the North. What always struck me as very strange was, I mean, I was from the North. I was from Belfast. I was from Ardoyne. I'd lived in the place that had suffered most from the Troubles, in terms of, if you were to just judge by the number of deaths, the number of sectarian deaths in it. I had had a lot of experience. Nobody ever asked my opinion, ever. I had to, during programme meetings, I would offer my opinion, which was routinely jeered at and on the subject of the North. So, yes, I think particularly as we moved into the phase where the hunger strikes particularly started to create a whole new dynamic, a whole new miserable edge to the rawness of Republican nationalist and unionist loyalist politics. It was missed by, there's no point in saying otherwise. I mean, it was missed by the English language current affairs in RTÉ, completely missed. And that's mystifying in its own right, because it was such a seminal time and such a, you know, really important time, and very important that people here would have understood what was, you know, how the tides were changing. But to some extent, I also understood that what was happening in the North was just so appalling that a lot of people just wanted to walk away from it. And, you know, a lot of people in Northern Ireland ran away from it, couldn't get away quick enough, you know, left the country, just got out of there. I mean, I had come to Dublin, it had driven me insane, and still I couldn't let it go. Yes, and then after that, you know, as you know, I mean, I left Today Tonight because I had completely lost all respect for the programme in relation to Northern Ireland. In other respects, it did good work. You know, outside of Northern Ireland, I would say the programme did really more than competent good work. So I left and went back into academic life, which I've never, ever regretted. But I did stay on in RTÉ, not working in that programme, but working part-time with a programme called Europa, working with Pat Kenny, for example, in radio. And in those two places, you know, I just found, again, great friendships, good people who restored my faith, really, in RTÉ and, you know, in the colleagues that I had there. So it was just that one slice. It just so happens that it was an extraordinarily important slice, not for me personally, but for, you know, for Northern Ireland.
And interestingly, Mary, do you think partly that attitude you experienced in Today Tonight, was that what initially people tried to throw at you at the beginning of your run for the presidency? Was that the same kind of undercurrent?
Oh, undoubtedly. You're spot on there, absolutely. Because what always struck me, in fact, one of the reasons why I eventually got around to writing the book was to tell, you know, of my background and to tell what formed me, you know, into really a very formidable opponent of the use of violence, was the realisation that there was a posse of journalists who didn't even bother to find out who I was or what I had done, the role that I had played, for example. Imagine that the Irish Council of Churches and the Catholic Church had asked me to co-chair probably one of the most seminal documents to come out of the Troubles, which was a working document on sectarianism. And you can you imagine that they would have asked me to do that unless they were pretty sure of my stand in relation to violence, which would be completely hostile to violence, that had been earned over many years working in the field of ecumenism, you know, working in the field of cross-community relations. You know what? I don't think one single journalist got that. The one exception probably was Tom Kelly in the North, who I wouldn't regard as part of the Southern Posse. But yes, I mean, I think that they have questions that they probably have asked themselves. Maybe they haven't ever asked themselves. None of that was presented. It was just, oh, here's this, you know, Northern Provo back to annoy us, bearing in mind that's what I had been accused of. And indeed, when the Independent, the Sunday Independent, came very close to saying that I was sacked by RTE, which I never was, ever, for that very reason, I did sue and sue them successfully. I'll always, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'll take so much, and I do have, you know, I think a fair capacity for forgiveness and for tolerance, but there's also a kind of a line in the sand that I can draw and say no this far and no further.
I didn't realise you almost did pull out, didn't you, because of that attitude to you in the campaign. I think you were going to pull out the following morning until the narrative changed.
I you've no idea how close I came. I mean, I had made up my mind to, and one of the reasons was that for the 2 years before I ran for election, I was privy to and party to what is known now as the Hume Adams talks, which were so important and so seminal in bringing the IRA into ceasefire and creating the conditions that led to the peace process, and which came out of an idea by a priest called Father Alec Reid. And it was Father Alec who put it together that if John Hume could speak to Gerry Adams and explain his vision of healing these three-way relationships between the people in the North, between the people North and South, and between the people of Ireland and Britain. And if he could explain that, and Adams could then bring that to the tired men of the IRA and explain that politics was the way forward. It had a number of setbacks, it had a number of successes, but all the time, poor John Hume was being absolutely lacerated on all sides for engaging in talks with Adams. And at one point, because of this laceration from people like the Sunday Press, from members of John's own party, from, of course, unionists, vilification on all sides, I was asked, along with a man called Jim Fitzpatrick, who was chairman of the Irish News, a major newspaper in Northern Ireland, and one of the most decent men that ever God put on the planet, we were asked to try and be the people who would try and go out to these key influencers and explain to them that what was going on was John trying to bring the IRA's campaign to an end, that this was a noble objective and an absolute precursor, a prelude to peace. But these talks, Miriam, were private. They were secret. They had to be, because every time there was a whiff of them, John was lacerated on all sides, and the stress on him was just visible and dreadful. I had never disclosed my involvement in that. Why? Because I was I was never going to use it as a tool to be used in a political campaign. That was absolutely not the case. And I was never going to divulge those meetings and what they were doing. It wasn't my place to do that. When I was accused of, at one stage, of meeting with Adams, which was true, I was meeting him. I was also meeting John Hume, of course, and Father Alec. But the story, as it was told, was that I was friendly with Gerry Adams. I never met Gerry Adams at any stage before then until the context of those talks. And indeed, for a long many years afterwards, when I became president, I only met him in that context. And so I was under pressure, accused, as you know, by a fellow candidate of being unsuitable to be a president, because the accusation was that I was a fellow traveller with the provost. Nothing could have been so much further from the truth. I could never have revealed the Hume Adams talks. I just couldn't do it. So I thought the best thing is withdraw, to protect that those talks were so central to the peace process. And actually, I had agreed it, and I was quite relieved going to bed that night. I was dead happy. I was thinking, that's grand, you know, withdraw now and all the pressure will be off. And then the next morning, turned on the radio, and there was Father Brenton Callanan, who had asked me to join the peace ministry for the purpose of helping facilitating and helping the Hume Adams talks. He was on the radio telling people why I was meeting Hume and Adams, that I was no Provo. In fact, if I had been, of course, they'd never have asked me to join the peace ministry. But it was the heat of a campaign, you know, an electoral campaign. Awful things get done. Actually, poor old Eddie Roach during that campaign, for whom I've the greatest respect. Eddie, she took some abuse as well.
Yeah.
And of course, then I stayed in the campaign. But you have to understand that what was going on back home was that because of those allegations, my children and my father-in-law, who was minding them at home, were now at risk from being targeted by loyalists. Like, it wouldn't be the first time we've been targeted by loyalists. And we lived quite close to a very strong loyalist hinterland. But thankfully, at that time, the police force in Northern Ireland, which was then the RUC, they were very helpful at that time.
Your presidency had lots of highlights, but I suppose for most people, and maybe for yourself, it was the visit of Queen Elizabeth. Now, I gather it was your idea that she might say a few words in Irish, Mary.
I had suggested, that, among a number of things, that if she used a few Irish words, that it would go a long way, that the respect of doing that, because we were only going to get one speech from her, remember, during the 4 days. And so the speech was very important historically. And of course, one of part of our history is the absolute damage that was done to the Irish language quite deliberately by the British administration in the 19th century in Ireland that hurt still, about which there was righteous resentment. So one of the things I suggested was that she might consider saying a few words in Irish, not very many, just a few. There was pushback on that idea, and I understood why, Miriam. To be honest, it was, you know, it was sensible. Mm. What I was told by our side, and the same advice had been given to her, I think, on her side, was, look, there's such, you know, neuralgia around the Irish language that if, for example, she even said a few words and if she got one word wrong or stumbled, it could be seen as giving offence and could be misinterpreted and wouldn't be a good start. So I understood that perfectly. It was very risky. And so my view was, having discussed it back and forth, look, let it go. We'll not bother pushing it. But then sometime later, a friend of mine who had been the British ambassador to the Holy See and was then the High Commissioner in Islamabad, came by the Arras actually on his way back. His dad lives in Northern Ireland, so he called in to see us. And he said to me, you mentioned to the Deputy private Secretary, who was his mate, his friend, 5 words. What were they? And I said, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want this subject raised again. Leave it. He said, no, it's not for the Queen. It's not for Her Majesty. It's just for, he said, that my friend was sorry he didn't ask you what they were. He just wants them for his own record. And he took out from his pocket a scrappy old envelope. And I wrote the words out phonetically and I said, you know, these are not for Her Majesty the Queen now. We understand that. I had between them all, they played me very well, I have to say, because on the night when she got up to speak those words, even though earlier in the day, one of the people who worked with me, Maura Grant, came in to me all excited, having been over to Farm Lee back and forth, you know, making the final arrangements, saying, oh, they're all joking about the Queen practicing her Irish. And I said, what? And then she said, no, that's only a joke. And then the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Is there something going on here that I'm not sure about? Anyway, it turned out, of course, that she said those 5 words that I had written out phonetically. That envelope is currently in Perth, just outside of Perth, in Fremantle, where the said former ambassador is now working as vice chancellor in a university. And he keeps reminding me that it's one of his prized possessions. It never made its way to the man that it was intended for, may I say.
Well, look, I loved your book. It's called Here's the Story, Mary McAleese, a Memoir. It's published by Sandycove, which is, of course, part of Penguin. Mary, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me this morning.
Oh, not at all. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Miriam. It always is. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Mary. Take care.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Lots and lots of lovely reaction to Mary McAleese. Just a few of them. Jenny Blake goes, Mary McAleese speaking so powerfully this morning and Miriam bravely and unapologetically discussing clerical child sex abuse and the dynamics of sectarian community violence in her family. Anne Marie goes, Mary McAleese is one of my absolute heroes. I regard her as Ireland's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. My hubby has just presented me with a signed copy of her book. So that's my Sunday sorted. Apologies in advance to my family. It will be beans on toast for dinner and that'd be just fine, Anne Marie. Well, look, we move move on. Hallelujah, I sang when the door finally opened. I really did. Those were the words of my next guest, Billy Keane, as he reopened the doors of John B's pub in Listowel, County Kerry this week after 6 long months. His words, they were probably echoed right around the country, except Republicans, of course, here in Dublin City and County. But for those who have seen their first week of business in so long, what's it been like? Good morning, Billy.
Good morning, Miriam. It's great to be back on the pitch again. I went down to the bank to make a lodgement on the Tuesday, last Tuesday, and young Darry Hughes was the teller, and he said to me, "Bill, we're back in the game." it was just lovely and a great feeling. Great feeling, you know, because it was actually 6 months and 1 week, you know, and every day was torture. Well, it wasn't all torture, but most of it was. I found it really tough, but it was great to open up and meet people. And you know, the bit of money obviously is very important, but it was just meeting the people and seeing how happy they were. You know, it kind of validated what I've been doing for since I was about 10, really, I suppose. It validated that we were doing something right, and the pubs are such an important part of our society and to help us, you know, to have a bit of fun.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, Billy, that you found it very difficult. I was reading your column in the Irish Independent, and one of them back in March said it's the longest you'd previously closed the pub since your mum and dad passed away. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, when my mum died, she was the businesswoman, really. Dad was the dreamer. She was the one that looked after minor details like tax and things like that. I was to be upstairs trying to make up these masterpieces, you know. Yeah. And, you know, she used to kind of wander into him when he'd be right in the field or something and say, "Sign that check and put away the masterpiece for a minute," you know. We closed up, obviously, for the day of the funeral and the removal. But the night of the funeral, we had some of the family and just ourselves, and we had a few drinks for all time's sake. But we opened up again the following day. So it was, and it's 65 years now that our family are in the bar, you know, and it was terrible. I found it so hard. I've kind of spoken about crying and stuff, and one of my buddies said, "The only time I ever saw you crying before was when the Listowel Limits won the North Kerry Championship," but this was like tears of sadness. And then it was different, then, like, walking in the door, you know, last Monday I turned the key in the door, and I said, "Oh, this is just incredible," and I could kind of feel... I could feel that, you know, the customers were there, the old customers. I keep the, you know, the memorial cards you get when someone dies. Mm. I have about 20 of them, and I keep them in a little drawer, and I look through them every now and then. And didn't I kind of, I felt in a way, maybe I was, and there was no alcohol involved, and I felt in a way they were all there. I honestly did. I felt they were sitting up at the counter having a drink, and it was just such an incredible feeling to get it back open again.
And you know, Billy, do you feel the presence? I was lucky enough to meet your mum, Mary, of course. We were down with Prime Time. What an incredible woman. But do you feel her presence there as well when you went back in the other day?
Yeah, I do. I do. I have, there's a hairbrush up in the bathroom upstairs, you know. Mm. And it's exactly as it was when she died 5 years ago, the whole place. I haven't really, other than to fix the roof after a leak, I haven't touched it. And there's, you know, some of her hair is on the hairbrush. You know, some of the ribs of her hair. And sometimes I touch it. And, you know, it's like, you know, maybe the cynics would say it's static electricity, but I get a little charge, you know. So I feel she's around. I feel my dad's around. I remember one time this fella called us. He was some kind of a clairvoyant, or he had all these electrical things. And he says he was going to the houses, the homes of great Irish writers, and he'd get some kind of sign that dad was there. And my mother said to me, and she's been quite serious, she said, "Don't let that fella near this place. He'll only upset your dad." So she felt it was there. You know, maybe they were having a bit of a chat late at night. I don't know.
But it's interesting, Billy, you were saying how difficult you did find it. I mean, look, everyone listening this morning throughout the length and breadth of this country, they have found this whole COVID experience so difficult. How have you dealt with it? And going forward, do you worry or do you think it changes? You do?
Yeah, I am a worrier. You know, I try my best not to worry, but... I didn't cope with it very well. I wrote a book for a while, and then I got kind of bogged down when we were closed on the 20th of July. And it's like, what I worry about most is this, right? So we're open now, and you have this terrible kind of pull, you know, like, is everyone going to be safe? So I really tried my best. But every now and then some refugee from the donkey sanctuary will just jump up and act the Egypt, and you get him sitting down, and then you worry, will someone film it, and your career is in ruins because of 15 seconds before you get to them. And that kind of thing worries me. But what worries me most is that everyone will be safe, staff and our customers, you know, because there's a risk everywhere. But we've done as much as we can. I think the mental health benefits, if you just saw how happy our customers were, and they were just delighted. And, like, you know, we're doing our best, and I just hope we'll all be safe. That's what worries me the most. And it's a great honour to own John B's now. And unlike a lot of the poor publicans who had to borrow huge money, I got it for free. You know, my dad worked in England, and I feel a great sense of honour to be there. But I also feel a lot of pressure to keep it right, you know, just to do everything right, to have fun. Most of all, it's about fun in there. Mm. So, you know, we got a good few laughs. I wrote Monday or Tuesday about a lady called, she had three sets of twins. This woman was as good as yourself for having the babies, Miriam. She had three sets of twins, all girls. Her name was Phil Flynn, and she was lovely. And that was the first funny chat we had almost immediately Monday when we opened. Aww. And I said, three sets of twins, yeah. And she said, there were 17 years between the second last and the last sets of twins. And I said, how did that happen? And she said, you know yourself, a few drinks. And she said, I was going to call the girls Rosé and Shiraz. So, like, that got me going. That set the tone for the week. It got rid of my nerves, the nerves about opening. And I said, thank God we're back. I'm talking to funny women again at the pub. Oh. And it was like, it was absolute pure mental health renewal. And it's funny, you know, if you go through a bad time and then you kind of forget it once a good time comes, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, look, Billy, I always love talking to you. Hopefully I'll get down to see
Same
you down
that,
there
Miriam.
Soon. And mind yourself and don't worry about anything. You will always
do
everything
best.
Right.
I'll do my best. Yeah,
mind yourself. Thanks so much for chatting to me today. I just want to thank on sound today, Sheila Neve Wheel. Our BCO was Denise Davies. The producer was Tom Donnelly. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, have a lovely day. August Lawn.